Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with me this morning. We've got a great hour coming up. We've got Murray Howe coming on our show in just about 4 minutes. His dad, Mr. Hockey, he is the son of Gordie Howe. And I remember when I was about 10 years old going to see Gordie Howe play at the Met Center in Bloomington against the Minnesota North Stars. And when I saw him hit the ice, I thought, oh, my goodness, there he is. Anyway, we're going to talk to him in just a minute. I have in studio with me my good friend Patrick Albanese. You're used to hearing him Monday mornings.
This is the Friday edition.
This is the Friday edition of
the
morning.
Yeah.
Exactly. So
my Uber driver got lost. I was like, well, as long as we're in Minneapolis area, just head on. You pick up the tab for that, don't you?
I do, indeed.
$610.
Yeah. I will buy you breakfast. We'll call it even.
That's good enough.
So 9 lessons I learned from my dad is what Murray wrote about.
He just couldn't come up with 10.
He couldn't come up with 10. Well, he was number 9.
Dad was number 9. I caught the thing. I just thought, just did such an unusual number.
And you must have got a lesson you learned from your dad.
A lot of them.
Yeah.
More than 9.
Okay.
And I lost my dad at a very young age.
How old?
I was 13. He was 50.
Oh, boy.
So, you know, my whole life, and you've been through this.
I've been through that.
You know, so from the age of 13 to the age of 50, I just said, it's coming. You know, you just, it affects you.
Yeah.
Of course I learned a lot. You know, of course I learned to keep the plastic trash bag in the glove box just in case, you know, that was important. No, you know, it's, my dad was a finisher. We used to kind of have this, you know, if a task is once begun, never leave it till it's done, be the labor great or small, do it well or not at all.
Okay.
And that's haunted me, and I've hated it pretty much for most of my life.
but it's stuck with you, hasn't it?
You know what? I recite it all the time.
Yeah.
When I'm mired in something that I'm having a hard time getting over
and say it again. Say it again.
If a task is once begun, never leave it till it's done. Be the labor great or small, do it well or not at all.
I like it. Well,
yeah.
Tweet that out, Rebecca, if you would.
Yeah. It'll haunt you. But I do say that to myself when I'm stuck.
Yeah. And I'm sure your kids have heard it.
Yeah. Well, they're young enough where they're not liking it. But
right.
Yeah.
But, it's hard to have lost your dad at a young age, and
yeah.
when I look at this picture of Murray with his dad, it almost brings tears to my eyes. It's just so sweet.
Yeah, it is, and you know, not all of us have dads that are legends to the rest of the world, but they very often are legends just to us. And you know, I mean, I'm a dad now, and I'm trying to set that up,
mm-hmm.
you know, as best I can. And so, free kazoos for everybody.
Real nice.
Yeah. We're a musical family.
Yeah. And your children are how old again?
7 and 8.
7 and 8. Nice.
Yep.
Nice.
In that order.
Yeah. I figured.
No.
Figured. Well, nice to have you in studio with me.
I didn't realize how nice it was in here.
Oh, it's really nice.
Are those strata loungers?
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we had Barca loungers and we replaced them with strata loungers.
Yeah, but I don't understand. They make you put the quarters in yourself to get the little massage thing.
Of course they do. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, we're very cost conscious around here.
I think it's
just
smart.
Just so you know.
Well,
right?
A lot of that's got to go into your salary.
It does. All right, we'll take a break and when we come back. Dr. Murray Howe is going to be with us and I actually can't wait to talk to him. Be back in a minute. Welcome back to the show. It's 9 minutes after the hour. If you are like me, living in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and if you live in the state of Minnesota, you know that Minnesota is the state of hockey. And I grew up loving hockey, playing hockey, admiring players. There were few players that I admired as much as the son of the great Gordie Howe. And his son, Murray, Dr. Murray Howe, is with us this morning on the studio line. Good morning, Murray.
Good morning, Bill. How you doing?
I'm really well. I remember when I was about 10 years old and my dad took me to the Met Stadium in Bloomington where the Minnesota North Stars played the Detroit Red Wings. And when your dad stepped out on the ice, wow.
I'm almost choking up right
that's
now.
That's awesome.
What was the score?
I don't remember, but
he was something else.
Oh my goodness! And it was because he embodied so much of everything that any kid looked up to. He was an athlete. He was a gentleman. He was kind to people. He had this bigger than life. And of course, I'm going to let you talk about him, so I'll shut up. But oh my gosh, what was it like growing up with him as your dad?
As you could imagine, it was just beyond anybody's wildest imagination. I hit the jackpot when I adopted my parents because they were both equally amazing people. And as you said, just my dad was so gifted athletically, and he was a bright man, quick wit, and he was the most wonderful, generous, considerate gentleman, as you say, and just an honorable person and a patient person, and just everything that you could ever want somebody to be, he was. And as a father, he was just, he made everything so much fun, and even though he was famous, he didn't recognize he was famous, and that's what made him so great. His good friend, the late, great Hall of Famer Bill Gadsby, said once that everybody in the dressing room knew he was Mr. Hockey except for him.
And, I love that.
And it's really true. He didn't recognize his own athletic greatness, and that was really, that humility that he had just set him apart. But as a father, it carried over. When he got home, he was always present. I mean, he was there just for us and for my mom. He was always looking for things to do, and anything that he would do, he would invite us to do it with him, and he would just make every moment special, whether we were just going to the grocery store or digging up some, vegetables in the backyard. I mean, whatever we were doing, he just made it fun, and he would always make it an opportunity to teach us something and pass on his values. And both he and my mom tuck us into bed each night and take that time to really, listen to us and also to pass on their own values and just really, really bond. And because he was so superhuman athletically too, it was like having your own superhero in your house.
No kidding.
And so anything you did, it was just, I mean, he would crack open a lobster claw with his thumb and forefinger. It was, I'd never seen anybody be able to do that. And he would just stare in awe. when he would be tearing apart a room, if we were remodeling or whatever, he would just, if you give that guy a sledgehammer, I mean, he could just take down a whole house. And when we'd play any sport, it was just so much fun. We'd play football in the front yard, and you couldn't tackle him. He would just carry everybody across the goal line with him with the ball, and it was just it was astounding.
So you talk about your dad, not only wanting to play hard, but he always wanted to have fun too. And that's a spirit that I just love about hearing about your dad. There was the great Wayne Gretzky talking about an episode he had actually playing against him. And he said, I took the puck from him on the third or fourth shift. And he said, he came back and whacked me on the glove so hard I thought he broke my wrist. And he said, never take the puck away from me again. So he played hard, but he had fun, didn't he?
He really did. Some people might think of that as being kind of like not caring or being lackadaisical, but it was actually a part of his sports psychology. He knew that if he kept it fun, he would be much more, willing to keep working at it. And he knew for each of us kids that the most important thing is that we were enjoying ourselves and really, had a passion for what we were doing. Otherwise, it's just an uphill battle. You're trying to, bring your son to hockey practice, if he just doesn't want to go, is really fruitless, because he should be doing it for him, not for you. And my dad always talked about his own father, who didn't see him play hockey ever until he'd been in the NHL for 10 years. And so, you know, that kind of tells you that you don't need to beat your children on the head to, you know, play a sport or whatever. You just need to cultivate their passions and give them the freedom to do the things that they, you know, that they enjoy. And from it all follows from there. If you love something, you're just going to keep working at it and master it. And so he always, you know, wanted to keep it fun. And in hockey, he was always trying to be creative and look for new ways to handle the puck with a stick and places to bounce the puck off the board so it would pop right out in front of the net. And he was constantly, you know, the game just had so many extra dimensions to him because he loved it so much.
Yeah, Marie, what's it like watching old film of your dad? Because I think of those early days of hockey when I went to watch the games and nobody wore helmets. And our goalie for the Minnesota North Stars, Gump Worsley, he didn't even wear a mask when I first started going to those games. Can you imagine a goalie not even wearing a mask?
They were a different generation, that's for sure.
Yeah.
All these players that played in the 50s, they grew up during the Depression era where no one had anything, and yet they were happy. My father would say that he had the best childhood of anybody because he had the simple things that mattered. He had enough food to eat, and he had parents that loved him, and you know, gave him really the inspiration that he needed to be everything he could be. He had dyslexia or some type of learning disorder. He didn't know what that was back then in Saskatoon, but he failed third grade twice and got teased mercilessly at school and was called doughhead and this and that. But my grandmother just lifted him up and just said, "Gordy, you're a smart boy. Don't listen to anybody, and you're going to make something of yourself someday." And that's what he really needed. So he had so much gratitude for his upbringing and all the people in Saskatoon that believed in him and helped him to fill his dreams. And so he grew up in that way, and it was something where to be able to just wear a Red Wings uniform was just over the moon for him. And so if he got whacked in the arm or broken arm or slashed and he's got, you know, blood dripping all over his face, that he wouldn't complain because he was still so happy just to be out on that ice. And just in terms of the equipment and all that, they were used to playing with nothing but magazines in their
socks. Crazy. Yeah.
So for him to have any equipment at all, he was a huge bonus. And
yeah.
Of course, a helmet was just never a part of the plan. So
yeah. Murray, let me take a quick break. And when I come back, I want to find out about how your dad was and your family were so intensely family and friends oriented. That was what he considered his treasure. So we'll take a short break. Dr. Murray Howe was with me. It's 18 minutes after the hour. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to the show. It's 21 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Dr. Murray Howe. He's written a book called 9 Lessons I Learned from My Father. And his father was Mr. Hockey, the legend Gordie Howe. And so I'm just having I'm fussing over this whole conversation because growing up in the state of hockey here in Minnesota and being a big fan myself, I'm just thinking with great affection of the days of watching him. And when I would go and see the Red Wings play, I got to tell you, Murray, he was the only player I wanted to see hit the ice. I know he had teammates, but I wasn't that interested.
I was the same way when I watched. Yeah, he was where your eyes gravitated.
Yeah, And obviously, you probably met a bunch of hockey player legends. And I mean, I met Stan Mikita once, and I saw him up close, and I thought, okay, that face has seen some stitches.
And yeah, Mr. Hockey is obviously, you know, taken his share of stitches as well. And you know, it's interesting about him. Despite all the different injuries he had over his career, he would just never talk about any of that. He always died to himself. You know, it was never about him. He could have talked all day long, and I'm sure people would listen to, you know, him talk about all his injuries. But he just downplayed that. He just felt thrilled and, you know, honored to be out on the ice. And, you know, if his leg got cut off, he would just keep going. I mean,
oh, that's fantastic.
You know,
yeah,
unstoppable.
So I want to be generous with our listeners right now. You said you've got 9 lessons I learned from my father. I just kind of want to run through real quick. Live honorably, live generously, play hard, but have fun. Patience, patience, patience. Live selflessly, be humble, be tough, stay positive. Family and friends and family are like gold. Treasure them. I'd like to actually spend the last few minutes talking about that and how important family life was. Would your dad have allowed cell phones at the table during dinner?
Absolutely not.
I didn't think so.
We adopt a cell phone bowl, so all of our kids are now, of course, grown. My youngest is 22, but yeah, all cell phones go in a bowl. And no one can, and they're all on silent. So, and that is a part of him being present when he was, you know, before cell phones were ever invented. I mean, he was just there for us, and so was my mom. And so we carry that on. We really don't have, you know, many electronics on in our house during the daytime. We have our cell phone available, but that's about it. When we're talking to each other, we don't, you know, answer it. We just give that person our time.
Mm-hmm. And have you carried on that tradition in your own family, Murray, with your children? Growing up, did you have those meal times as critical and times together? And I know that was something your parents were
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And we still do, even though our children are now grown. We keep the dinner hour sacred, and we don't have the TV on or anything during that time. It's all a time to just share. And and now that our kids have all moved away, when we're together, it's so special. And to be able to just be the magic of being around the table and to be able to exchange, and it's just amazing the chemistry that happens there, and it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had 4 kids in your family, and you had 2 brothers that played pro hockey, and actually played alongside your dad, didn't they?
Yes. My brothers were almost as remarkable as my father.
Wow.
My brother Mark was the youngest player to ever play on an Olympic hockey team. He was 16 at the time. They had Mark Howe Day at his high school. He was a sophomore in high school at the time. So he went over to Sapporo, Japan, and after he brought back his medal, I used to, whenever he wasn't home, I would put that medal around my neck and walk around the house and pretend that I had won it.
How funny, Larry.
And Marty was a tremendous track athlete. He set all the high school records as a freshman, which was just unbelievably, broke all the senior records and was All-American in football as a freshman. He was 210 pounds and 6'1" when he was 14 years old. So he was really a remarkable athlete. And I looked up to my brothers so much. I mean, they were just incredible. They were not only great athletes, but they were also really great older brothers. I joke that they picked on me a lot, and they did, but only in a loving sibling way. You know, that's just what you do, is you pick on your little brother. And you know, now we have a fantastic relationship.
Mm-hmm. Now, and you decided to go into medicine. Is there a future there?
I was really fortunate that when I wanted to play hockey more than anything, and I dedicated my entire childhood to that goal. I played up in Toronto with Gretzky and Paul Coffey, and did everything I possibly could to be a pro, but I just lacked talent. And University of Michigan as a walk-on, and that just I got back to my dorm and called my parents, and they just said, "Well, thank God we don't have to worry about you anymore."
Oh, funny!
I'm only 5'6" and 140 pounds, so it was a big challenge for me, and I never backed down, but it wasn't easy. And so that opened the doors for me. I always say that being cut from the team was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it allowed me to pursue then my talents and passions, which were really in sciences. And I was fortunate enough to get into University of Michigan Medical School. And I've had just a wonderful career in sports medicine imaging in within radiology. And I feel so fortunate that I found something that I love as much as my dad loved hockey.
Yeah. And you can still wear a number 9 on the back of your white doctor's coat, can't you?
You know, that's a brilliant idea. I never thought about them wearing my white doctor coat right now, and I should just put a number 9 right on.
I would.
That would be fantastic.
I would. Murray, your book is one once you pick it up. Of course, I have a love for hockey and an interest in your dad and the stories of your family. I just couldn't put it down. It was just a blast to go through. So thank you for writing it.
That's so great. It was truly my honor and pleasure, and that is the greatest. That is my reward in writing this book. To me, it never mattered to me if I sell any copies. But it's thrilling for me to know that anybody is reading it, because I feel it's my sharing of my father with the world, and he just had such a beautiful spirit, and I just wanted to pass on what he stood for and who he was as a father and a man, because in this day and age, I really think we need more heroes. We need some true knights in shining armor, and he really is. I can't think of a bigger hero than him. He just stood for so much good, and I'm thrilled that anybody, you know, can read the book and take some of him, you know, and help them to be better people.
Murray, thanks so much. Great having you as a guest. Have a great weekend.
Oh, thank you. My honor and pleasure, Bill.
Thank you so much. It's 29 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, thank you to Dr. Murray Howe. I wonder if he got good seats at the arena. I bet he did.
Ringside seats.
That is my dear friend Patrick Albanese, who's in studio. We're doing our Monday edition on a Friday. How cool is that? We'll take a little break for news, and then Chris Martin will be back with us, our millennial evangelical. Back in a minute.
And he blames it all on us who are 24 hours a day.
Finding encouragement together.
I have actually grown up listening to this with my parents driving in the car.
Well, I could definitely tell you there have been days where I felt like the programming that I was listening to was absolutely geared for what I was going through that day. There were many times where I was just absolutely defeated from situations during the day, and listening to the programming, I would feel completely rejuvenated, refreshed, like God had that word planned specifically for me.
Thanks for making us your radio home, Faith Radio.
Would you like to ride? 25 minutes until the top of the hour. So glad you're with me this morning. I have in studio my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines, Patrick Albanese, who we're doing our Monday edition on Friday.
Friday. I am. I'm just here for the knishes.
Yeah, right.
I love the fact that you have your show catered.
I do. It's really nice.
It's really nice. Yeah.
So great conversation with Murray Howe, his dad, of course, Gordie Howe, and I felt a little overwhelmed with emotion at one point.
Yeah, but I see. And
father-son thing, isn't it?
We were talking, you know, unbeknownst to the listener, we were talking to ourselves. which is, you know, believe it or not, we do that. And yeah, it's the father-son connection. And, you know, you used to go watch his dad play. You used to go to the games with your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, how do you not get emotional? My dad was an accountant.
Yeah.
But one of his clients was the shortstop for the Chicago Cubs way back in the late 60s, early 70s, Don Kessinger. And I remember going to his house once, and then one time when he came to our house and he brought Paul Popovich, who would sometimes play second base or sometimes play shortstop. Mm-hmm. And they're in my backyard playing jarts, which were legal back then.
You know, they're not anymore.
Yeah, those missiles.
Right.
You just threw at somebody, those things.
Right.
And, you know, all my buddies, of course, are hanging on the fence, and they're going, he's got the shortstop in the second baseman for the Chicago Cubs in his backyard. I was a celebrity. And, you know, it was this great bonding thing, and we would occasionally get to go to Cubs games, and we'd get some great seats. You know, as long as the taxes were done correctly.
Right.
You're in the nosebleed. It's like, Dad, what happened?
Yeah, I made a few mistakes on the...
forgot a deduction.
Yeah.
So now I get emotional watching the Cubs because I lost my dad at a young age. And, you know, if I get that rare chance, a couple of years back, I went with a mutual friend of ours. He had some tickets. He says, you want to go to Wrigley? I said, are you kidding me? And I can't help but walk into that stadium and have that all happen.
I know.
You know, so my dad obviously had an impression on me. Yours had one on you. Howe's dad obviously had an impression on him. And it all comes together, and we're just a weeping mess in here right now.
Well, it's because you lost your dad when you were 13.
Yep.
And your dad was only 50, and there were seven or eight kids in your family?
Eight of us.
Eight of us.
That I recall. There was a lot of running around.
Yeah, there's a lot of activity.
Yeah.
And my father, of course, died when I was 8 months old. And then my stepfather died when I was 17. And he was the one that would take me to the games. And I remember just how thrilling it was.
Yeah.
And he was a former athlete as well. I mean, not on a professional level, but on a college level. He was a captain of the Minnesota Gophers hockey team and tennis team. So he was a great athlete. And I remember at one point we were leaving the Met Stadium after a hockey game. And he said to me, I'm so proud of you, the way you meet adults and the way you shake their hands and look them in the eye. And I have never... ever forgotten that.
Yeah. Do you still do that or no?
It's still in my head.
It's still in my head
because that meant so much to me.
Well, and part of the bonding that happened in those situations, you know, sometimes there'd be another sibling with me at the Cub game. But occasionally when you're one of, you know, many kids and you were one of many kids,
mm-hmm.
when you say, I got alone time with a parent, you know, with my mom, sometimes it might just be the grocery store, but you said, it's just me and mom.
Yeah.
And
big deal, isn't it?
It's a big deal. And boy, do those stick with you. And I make sure with my kids to try to go, you know, my wife and I are always big on get some alone time with each of them where they say, just you and me.
Right.
You know, it's just daddy daughter time or daddy son time.
Yeah.
And, I'm hoping this sticks. It stuck with me.
Yeah, because you don't want your last undivided time of attention with your mom is when she delivered you.
All right, that's enough of that.
That's enough of that. Take a break and bring on Chris Martin, who, by the way, Patrick, is the number one Chicago Cubs fan in maybe the whole world.
So I love it.
Yeah, we'll bring him on in just a minute. It's 20 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be back.
How do you handle behavioral issues with your team when he splits his time between two homes, especially when the ex-wife or ex-husband hold completely different standards? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. How are we supposed to be good parents when it's only a part-time job? Well, for starters, be consistent with what you believe. If you're divorced and your teen moves between two households, understand that you can't control your ex. So stick with the rules, boundaries, and consequences that you believe to be right for your home. Consistency will help you be the best mom or dad for your kid, whether you're full-time or part-time. And someday, your son or daughter will thank you for sticking to it and providing the stability they desperately need.
Are you struggling with your teen? Take Mark Gregston's free online course, Tough Guys and Drama Queens. Go to ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Good morning. It's 19 minutes after the hour. Chris Martin is the co-creator and chief content officer at Lifeway Social, as well as author development specialist at Lifeway. He and his wife, Susie, live outside Nashville, and he is, we refer to him as the millennial evangelical. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, good morning.
And say hi to Patrick.
Hi, good morning. I went to your webpage, and I got to say, for a guy who's 1,000 years old, you look good.
That's thanks.
It's amazing. I had no idea. I keep hearing about these millennials, and I'm looking for old-looking people.
Yeah,
but turns out they're kind of young.
He looks good.
He looks good.
Now, you guys might be the two biggest Chicago Cubs fans I know, so if you guys want to have your little private moment, you go ahead, but don't take too long.
Yeah, I won't. Well, what do you want to talk about? I mean, Ernie Banks, Mr. Cub,
sure.
Yeah, you know what?
Well, how did you celebrate last year?
I just finished.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was a heck of a party. It ended a couple of days ago. it's a whole lifetime of you remember the 84 Cubs. I remember them setting some of those dubious records of, hey, you know, nobody's ever gone from two games up and blown it, except for the Chicago Cubs.
Right.
You know, so to see them come from, you know, three games down and to pull it out in a game seven, you say, I'm sorry, I know I'm biased because I'm a Cub fan, but that's the best World Series I have ever, ever watched. And it was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right.
My wife and I went to Wrigleyville during the World Series. We flew up from Nashville to Chicago. We're from around Chicago. And so,
are you a suburban
and so
kid?
We, I'm from Indiana, but close enough to Chicago.
Oh, no, that's considered,
down in the south.
That's considered Chicago. 90% of Indiana is considered a Chicago suburb.
Exactly. Yeah. So we went up to Wrigleyville, and we were there when the games were going on in the World Series. And even though they were down, the atmosphere was still so electric. You wouldn't have known we were down at that point 2-1 and then eventually 3-1. But it was just so incredible. So that's
cool.
Were
you there for game seven?
No. We were back in Nashville for Game 7, unfortunately. Okay. I would have loved to be there for Game 7.
Yeah, but then we couldn't be friends.
That's true.
Yeah. All right, Chris, let's move on to an article that you wrote about Facebook designing to exploit a psychological vulnerability. Explain that.
Yeah, so anyone who's watched The Social Network, the movie, might remember – it's a movie about Facebook, came out a few years ago. I don't know, maybe like 2012, 11 even. It was a movie about Facebook and how it was founded and Mark Zuckerberg. And in the movie, there's – Justin Timberlake is in the movie. And the guy he plays, his name is Sean Parker. Now, if you've been paying attention to the internet, you know, for very long, especially in the late 90s, early 2000s, really before I was paying attention to who these people were, what are the real trailblazers on the internet that really changed and disrupted normal life as we know it? His name is Sean Parker. And that's the guy that Justin Timberlake plays in the Social Network movie. If you remember the movie, because that's how a lot of people came to know who Sean Parker even was, Sean Parker founded Napster, which was an illegal music downloading service that basically was the service that became like that created pirating music. That's what Napster was in the late 90s and early 2000s. And Sean Parker created that, but he really kind of disrupted the music industry. I mean, I really think if you use Spotify or any other music online music service today, you kind of have Sean Parker to thank, even though he was breaking the law. And so Sean Parker was an early investor in Facebook. He kind of came alongside Mark Zuckerberg, and Sean Parker was actually the first president of Facebook when it became an official company. He gave Zuckerberg a lot of money and kind of taught him to make Facebook from a Harvard experiment to a global business. And so today, Sean Parker is a billionaire, obviously, for obvious reasons, having invested in Facebook and been an early person there. But he was speaking recently. He was being interviewed by Axios, which is a media company. And he was being interviewed about Facebook and what social media is like. And he kind of said some disturbing things. He basically said that Facebook is designed to exploit a psychological vulnerability. So hackers' purpose is to exploit code vulnerabilities. So they go to websites or, you know, applications or whatever, and they exploit vulnerabilities in the code in order to break it and steal something or whatever. And so really what he described, it was like any good hacker, Mark Zuckerberg has developed a a social media platform that is designed to exploit a vulnerability. But in this case, it's not a vulnerability in some code. It's a vulnerability in our own minds. Facebook was designed – Sean Parker, who was one of the first people involved with Facebook, he said Facebook was designed to create a sort of – and we've heard this before. If you've heard me talk about social media, if you've read anything about social media – social media is designed to create a sort of drug-like addiction to where you receive likes, notifications of any kind, comments, shares, whatever, which then drives this sort of social feedback loop that makes you want to post more content so you can garner more admiration from your friends. And really, you're just building up these social media platforms as you do it. So you give your time and energy to Facebook. Facebook gives you admiration and affirmation, and then Facebook becomes the biggest company, biggest social media company in the world. And so he explained that this week, which was kind of disturbing, as you can imagine. One of the guys who was one of the earliest people at Facebook talking about that.
Mm-hmm. Chris, I need to go to break here just in a minute, but when I come back, I want to ask you about you talk about exploiting vulnerabilities and the way in which younger kids especially, and maybe older people as well, they try to find the perfect video or the perfect picture to keep their profile up and their likes coming. And you talk about this addiction. Boy, it sounds like it's real and it's not going away. I'm talking to Chris Martin, the Millennial Evangelical. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. I'll be right back. Good morning. 10 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm talking to Chris Martin. Always enjoy talking to Chris. Chris, I was talking to a checkout kid at the grocery store, and I said, you look a little tired this morning. Did you get some sleep last night? And he goes, nah, I was up till about 3:30. I said, how come? He goes, I was looking through my feed. I thought, activity happens up until midnight, and then people start processing their evening, and that becomes the feed, which lasts till 3:30 in the morning. And I thought, this is pretty addicting, isn't it?
Yeah, man, it's crazy. And like, I'm really glad that I'm not a teenager right now for a whole host of reasons, but one of them being that I don't have to deal with this. I mean, when I was a teenager, MySpace, when I was, an early teenager, MySpace was the primary social media platform. When I got into high school, Facebook became the primary social media platform, and Instagram and all the others that have come after it weren't really, and Twitter had started while I was in high school as well, but not many people were actually using it.
Well, when Bill and I were teenagers, the primary social media platform was detention.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
That's where you got to know people.
Right. Exactly. And so, and then, I've not been a teenager in the age of Snapchat and Instagram, which are just so different from Facebook and the other platforms, for the main reason is that they're image driven. And that image driven social media, I think it's concerning in a way that other social media like Twitter or Facebook, even though obviously there are images on Facebook, but it's not dominated by images in the way that the others are, because these image-driven social media platforms are just wreaking havoc on teenagers and their brains. Like Sean Parker in that interview that I was talking about before, he was like, God only knows what social media is doing to our children's brains. And this is one of the guys who was like – in the ground floor of the social media revolution. And so he's kind of said he's a conscientious objector to social media and is trying to keep his kids off of it as well as they get older. So I think it's, as we consider young people today, which is iGen, the generation coming after millennials, as we consider young people, we have to understand that, like the kid you talked to in the grocery checkout line, mm-hmm. like, depression is at such a high rate among those kids that we ought to, like, it really should just be default for us to assume that they're not happy with themselves. Like the stats that I've been reading about how social media is affecting the mental fitness of young people is, all these just image-driven social media platforms are making so many of them think that they're not good enough, whether they just like, I'm not living a cool enough life, or I don't look good enough, or, whatever it is. It's just everything is All of the comparisons that maybe came with the early iterations of social media are only getting exponentially worse as social media platforms get more and more personal, more and more image driven, and just more and more pervasive. I mean, young people are not rushing out to get their licenses. I help with the youth group at our church, and I picked a kid up to take him to youth group a couple weeks ago, and I was like, hey, you're 16, like, why don't you have your license? You know, thinking maybe you just can't afford a car or something like that. And he was like, I'm just not really in a rush to get it. Like, my parents take me places and stuff like that. And so 16-year-olds, you know, I'm sure this is the case when you guys were turning 16. But, I mean, even just 11 years ago – goodness, it makes me shudder to think that. But 11 years ago when I was turning 16, I rushed out to get my license, as did all of my friends. Getting a license was a means of social freedom. Today, young people are not rushing out to get their licenses because they don't need social freedom via a car. They have it via their phones.
Hmm. Plus, gas is expensive.
Exactly.
They don't want to buy a car. I get it.
Right. Right.
I find, you know, you were talking about the depression aspect of it. I spend a few minutes on Facebook and I say, I am noticeably less happy. I've actually labeled it. It's like an art form. We've had expressionism. I call it depressionism. You know, you spend a couple minutes on Facebook, and I say, what happened? Why have I walked away from that? It's not that I've watched people, you know, eating pastries in France, going, boy, that's not me. Something else has happened. You know, sometimes it's just maybe the arguing, but it really has an effect, a physical effect.
Right. Yeah. And like, I coach people on social media strategy all the time and stuff. And I tell them, you know, one of the things I notice is that, and this is just, it's the sad reality, but it's the reality that negative content on social media, if you're to look at the analytics, you know, there are all kinds of ways to approach a particular topic. So let's say you're just reporting the weather, right? Let's say it's sunny outside today. You can either report, hey, it's sunny outside today, or drought persists for 8th straight week, or whatever you want to say. There are two ways to report a given topic, positive or negative. On social media, without fail, the negative version always does better than the positive version. And it's because people use social media to commiserate. I mean, really, that's what it comes down to. Negativity persists on social media because people would rather get together to talk about what they don't like than to get together and talk about what they do like.
Yeah, great word, Chris. Yeah. And we can always look for ways to use social media to inject the gospel and give hope to people, because you never know what's going to get through. So we should never stop in that mission to advance the gospel, using any way we can.
Yeah, and that's like when I consider these stats and what social media is doing to people, I'm like, okay, I just want to be done and go like work on a farm or something and never touch this stuff again.
Right.
But then I'm reminded of the responsibility that I think we have as Christians to use any means we have available to us to share the gospel with people. And that's kind of why I continue to labor in this work that I am continually finding more and more concerning.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your work, and I appreciate you being a guest of the show. I always like having you on. So thank you, Chris, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, you guys, too.
You bet.
Thanks.
Yep, 4 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a break and then wrap up the big show. That wraps up our show. A big thanks to Chris Martin, our millennial evangelical, and Dr. Murray Howe. His book, 9 Lessons I Learned from My Father. You can shoot over to Amazon.com and check that book out. I think you get the first chapter for free. You should at least go read that, if not buy the book. And Dr. Alex McFarland and Carmen LaBurge, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And also to my good friend Patrick Albanese, my friend and colleague from prestigious West Des Moines, who happens to be in studio right now. And we're off to breakfast.
Yes, we are.
Thanks so much for being here. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'll see you Monday. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend, and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.